The way that psychedelics work is that they are non-specific amplifiers of awareness. My most meaningful psychedelic experiences were probably in my ketamine training. I think we can start to cure mental illness rather than just treat it in the next 5 to 10 years. Money is as addictive as cocaine. Apollo helps to calm the body by reminding us we're safe and we're not under threat. Once I started using Apollo, my deep sleep doubled.
Hello, how are you, Dave?
Good. Been a crazy day already.
It's 3 p.m. I heard you were located in San Francisco, is that right?
Yeah, well, right now in San Francisco, we're in between New York and San Francisco most of the time.
Huh. Is your company split between both sides, or do you have two different types of work?
No, we're a fully remote team. Our company is based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where we founded out of the University of Pittsburgh research that I was doing there. And that's where the company's still headquartered. And I'm from San Francisco Bay Area, and my wife's from New York, so we split time in between.
Got it. Do you guys fly together? Are you guys always together and just flying back and forth to each other's families, or sometimes you guys are just like separate?
I mean, sometimes we're separate because I travel around and do a lot of speaking engagements. So Catherine doesn't always travel with me, but we're married and co-founders, so we travel together a lot.
Got it. Yeah, Dave, how I first came about you, I think I was scrolling through Instagram and I was going through Reels and I just started seeing all these cool sort of conversations and clips of you talking about stress, talking about psychedelics, and that's something I've been sort of jumping down that rabbit hole, and that's sort of how I came accustomed to you, Dave.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it's one of my favorite topics. And Apollo actually came out of my research in the psychedelic space, so we can talk about that later too. Have you tried Apollo yet?
Have not. That's the ankle bracelet, right?
Oh yeah, it works anywhere on the body. I'm wearing it on my chest right now, with a clip, so you can see it looks like that. And you can just wear it anywhere. We can send you one to try out. If you do you have an iPhone by chance?
I have an iPhone. I use an Aura ring. That's sort of what I've been using for the last 5, 6 years. I don't know. Yeah, tell me about the product.
Yeah, so Apollo is the newest version of wearable technology. It's what's called it's what would you would call a Gen 3 wearable. So the Gen 2 wearables, which is Oura Ring, Whoop, Fitbit, Apple Watch, things like that, they track your data only, and then at best they give you suggestions of what to do, but they don't actually do anything for you to change how you feel. So we saw that as a big weakness in the wearable space back in 2016, and Gen 2 wearables were just starting to come into the market around that time, and people were just a lot of people were if you weren't a biohacker or an elite athlete or somebody who really cares about your data, people were just throwing them in their drawers. And so we decided to make a wearable based on our research that could actually change the body and change how you feel. Rather than just tracking you, Apollo delivers soothing vibrations to your body that actually improve your heart rate variability and your sleep just by you wearing it. And if you have an Oura Ring, you'll love Apollo because we just released in November a generative AI. It's actually the first of its kind that takes your Oura data from your wearable and then processes it in our back end and then uses a custom algorithm to generate vibes for you that improve your Oura metrics. So if you put your Oura and your Apollo together, your Oura data will get better automatically. And we've seen people like triple their HRV and their Oura within 3 months.
Whoa. So like I've been using the ring for the last 5 years. So I have 5 years worth of sort of data. Over the last year, I've been starting to track if I've been doing afternoon walks, if I've been eating oily food, if I've been meditating, if I've been exercising, how many works hours of work I do, if I read the night before, if I masturbated the night before. And like I'm just collecting all this data. I haven't correlated it to my sleep score yet. I've sort of threw the data into ChatGPT and see if there's any correlation, but I think 100 days of me saying yes or no to those activities might not be enough data. But that's sort of what I've been doing on my end. So what you're doing, that sounds really freaking interesting.
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's the newest wearable ecosystem, right? So data from wearables is only as useful as you make it by changing your behavior, right? But if you're really stressed out, busy, overwhelmed, and you're then change becomes hard. And so we were, and I saw this with my patients with PTSD. You know, we're really just trying to come up with new ways to help them feel better. And wearable technology does not help them feel better. It just tracks them. And so when we made this actually changed how they felt and improved their symptoms and reduced how much medicine they were taking. And then when we released the partnership with Oura Ring this year, we actually were able to see Oura data skyrocket for people. And we're publishing one of the world's largest interventional sleep studies this year, in partnership with Oura, where we show that Apollo use over 3 months actually gets you some of these really nice metric improvements like HRV, resting heart rate improvements, and sleep improvements. The first study that's coming out is on sleep, and the second one will be on heart rate data.
Interesting. How does the vibrations from the Polo help you get better sleep, less stress, higher HRV?
Do you have your iPhone with you?
Yes, I do.
Download the Apollo app on your iPhone real quick.
Okay.
App Store.
Type in APOLLO.
Search APOLLO Apollo.
And then NEURO. You should see it pop up.
Oh, Neuro. Got it. Apollo Neuro.
And then download the purple app.
Okay, let me see.
And then when it downloads, just open it.
Okay, get it.
And then
Perfect.
I can show you the experience on your iPhone.
That's crazy. Wow.
Apollo is actually a software platform that runs on anything that vibrates, but we couldn't do that back in 2020 when we launched because the other hardware was not good enough to do that. But now we can actually give you a demo through your iPhone, which is fun.
Huh. Okay, just finished downloading. Let me open up the app. I'm gonna record my screen so my edits, I can throw this up as well. That'll be fun.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm gonna record my screen now. All right, so I got the app. I'm gonna click Feel Apollo, designed by Neuroscience Vibes, calm your body, clear your mind. Okay, very cool.
You feel your phone vibrating?
Not yet. Hold your phone against your chest, relax, and take a few deep breaths. What?
Can you feel the vibration?
Think so. My phone isn't vibrating. I don't know if it's the case. I feel my heart though.
Oh, you should no, you sh it should be pretty obvious. What kind of phone do you have? What iPhone version?
iPhone 12 Pro.
Yeah, it should work. You don't feel your phone buzzing?
Well, maybe it's because I have a mic
Oh.
plugged in. Let me try unplugging
Oh,
it.
maybe.
Okay. Oh, now I can feel it. Yep, now it's
Oh, yeah.
vibrating.
So now hold that to your chest.
I hold it to my chest. So it stopped vibrating now.
It should go in a wave.
Okay, let me click feel again. Transvicular cord vibrations.
Your screen needs to be on for it to work.
Feel
Yeah, hit
Apollo.
feel Apollo. You feel it buzzing?
Design
Design
not
not yet.
yet. Hold
Hold
your
your
phone
phone
against.
against.
Okay, cool.
It should vibrate in a gentle wave that kind of goes up and down, like a cat's purr.
Couldn't
Couldn't
feel
feel
it
it
yet.
yet.
Let me
Let me
try
try
it.
it. Oh, you don't feel it?
Yeah.
That's weird. I've never seen that happen before.
Let me
Let me
try
try.
one more time because it was vibrating once when I was just holding
Yeah.
it.
Oh, yeah. Try closing the app and just
Good idea.
reopening it.
I'm going to close the
And
app.
yeah, and just,
Reopen it.
yeah, try that. And then,
I guess I don't have a wearable for now.
yeah. So then, yeah, then wait, then it should say feel Apollo. And then in 1 sec, try clicking that. Yeah, click that button one more time.
Click the button.
Is it buzzing now?
Not yet.
Oh, it should
I'm
start right.
still
It should
recording. Let me turn off the screen. Oh,
start.
I feel it. I feel it. It's vibrating.
Okay. So you feel a slow wave going up and down?
Oh, the vibration stopped. What? Okay, let me. Oh, I feel it again.
It should come and go. So it'll come for about 5 or 10 seconds, then it'll fade out, and then it'll come back again. And that's a very specific rhythm that we discovered in the lab that induces a state in the body called coherence, which is when our heart and lungs are resonating together. And when you can do this with breathing, if you breathe in for 5 seconds and out for 5 seconds, you'll naturally get yourself into that state. And that's what the whole field of biofeedback is based on. So that state is the state at which our vagal tone starts to go up and our heart rate variability starts to improve. And you can see benefits in as little as 3 minutes in the lab. But with the wearable, there's like 10 or 12 different settings. You can set them for different energy levels, different mood states, and it will, using AI, it can turn on automatically throughout the day and night for you to keep you in flow. So basically it helps nudge you into like parasympathetic flow and then keeps you there.
That is crazy. So, is it tracking your heart rate live and
No, it's
seeing?
not doing any. Is it, you actually don't need to track anything to get the basic effect, because the what's been proven with the field of biofeedback is that every single person, basically every single human being, when we enter a meditative state, we pass through a 5 to 7, a calming meditative state, not like intense holotropic breathing, but the calming, relaxing meditations. You pass through 5 to 7 breaths per minute pattern, and that pattern is the pattern at which we start to feel more calm, and our blood pressure comes down, and our heart rate comes down, and our heart rate variability goes up. And so that rhythm is conserved across all humans. And if you send that rhythm to people, they naturally get into that state. Just like holding a purring cat or having somebody you like give you a hug or having ocean waves wash over you, it's like that same kind of feeling.
Ah, so right now, as you're wearing the wearable on your chest, is it vibrating every 5 to 10 seconds?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And by wearing that, I guess, full time, people have seen an improvement in their health after doing that for 3 months.
Yeah, I mean, most people see improvement before that, but if you wear it consistently, like almost every day for 3 months, using and you schedule it and have it vibrating on your body about 3 hours a day, which we make it really easy in the app, then we see people getting dramatic effects. So like up to 30 minutes more sleep a night that's concentrated and deep in REM. So that's like as good or better than Ambien in terms of increased sleep duration, but Ambien makes your deep and REM sleep worse. So this actually improves it by calming the body. And then we also see HRV improvements of up to 11%, resting heart rate improvements of 4%. And those just continue to improve over time as you continue to use it, because it gives you the benefits of it's what meditation and breathing do for us. So it gives you the benefits of that if you've never learned how to do it. And if you have learned how to do those natural techniques, it helps you get there faster.
That is a game changer. Is the psychology, is it like, do you feel that vibration in it? Is it like a constant like reminder to stay in the present? And is that what it's causing?
That's part of it. That's called somatic embodiment. So if you were to get a hug from somebody or have somebody you like hold your hand, that is doing the same thing, where you're basically taking your mind, which can be anywhere, past, present, or future, and you're centering it back into your body, which then and your our bodies are always present, so it brings us back into the present. But it also boosts vagal tone. And boosting vagal tone is an all-cause indicator for recovery and relaxation, sleep, and general overall clarity, cognitive function, et cetera, in the body.
Yeah, and I think just off this conversation, Dave, you're such a present, calm person where, we sort of, you're a bit late to the meeting, but you're so super cool and we're trying to figure out the app. We couldn't figure it out, but you're still really chill and I'm here trying to figure out the app, seeing how much time we have left for the it's, and my mind is racing, but you're like so chill.
It's practice. The more you do it, the easier it gets. But we should all be learning this as kids, you know, like if our parents knew or schools knew to teach this to us when we were children, you know, we'd all be able to do this really easily because we would have learned it young. But starting with like learning how to breathe properly, but most of us never learn how to breathe properly. So you never actually know how to get yourself into these states naturally. And I never learned that growing up. So when we started working on this, we were trying to give people the benefit of what it feels like to enter a meditative state, even if you've never actually been there of your own doing.
Talking about breathing, I did a sleep study and I stopped breathing 15 15 times every hour, I think, or every minute. I can't remember. The average is 5, and sleep apnea is 30, so I'm in between. So I've been using a CPAP machine over the last 6 months, and it has, I guess, improved my sleep. I think efficiency is up. I get more deep, more REM. Do I need to continue using the CPAP, or is there a way where I can fix my breathing where I don't need to use a CPAP?
Do you have obstructive sleep? Do you have obstructive sleep apnea? Did anybody diagnose you with anything like that?
I used to have a deviated septum, and then I got that operated, so that's straight. I have nothing obstructive in my nose or my throat, apparently.
So that's good. So it could be stress related. And so if it's stress related, then Apollo absolutely can help with something like that, because it just reminds the body to breathe properly. The way we're supposed to be breathing when we're sleeping or awake. If you have obstructive sleep apnea, like there's actually a physical reason why you're not breathing, if you're, morbidly obese, or which you're obviously not, or you have, some kind of issue with your physical nasal passages or something like that, which it sounds like you don't anymore, then that can also contribute to it. But Apollo doesn't really help with that. But with the stress-related stuff, it really helps improve that. So we can send you one to try out.
I'd love that. One thing I do notice is my mouth, ever since I was born, when I sleep, my mouth jaw drops and air goes through I breathe through my mouth and my mouth gets dry and I wake up. So now I've been using tape.
To close
Oh
to
yeah, mouth tape
close.
is very popular now for that.
Was I just born with a loose jaw or something?
No, it's literally just that we never learned how to breathe properly. And many of us, myself included, like we breathe through our mouths more often than we should. We're supposed to breathe through our noses almost all the time. And a lot of the time we wind up breathing through our mouths because we just weren't taught how to breathe properly. And that actually changes the entire shape of our face structure over time. So I don't know if you've ever read, if you want to learn more about this kind of stuff, check out James Nestor's book called Breathe. He does a really nice expose on breath and mouth breathing versus nose breathing, and kind of breaks down like how we were not taught to breathe properly and why that has an impact on us long term and can result in sleep apnea and some of these other things. And he's not a scientist himself, but he does a really great investigative kind of journalist report of breathing, and that'll answer a lot of your questions around this kind of stuff. It's really interesting.
Yeah, if we were to tie the knot and answer those last two questions, how do you breathe better, Dave?
Well, so if you look at, so number one, breathe through your nose almost all the time. When you catch yourself breathing through your mouth, just notice that you're breathing through your mouth and then just redirect your attention to breathing through your nose. That makes a huge difference. The more you breathe through your nose, the easier it gets to breathe through your nose and you stop thinking about it as much. If you find yourself mouth breathing at night, the mouth taping can be really helpful to make sure that you force yourself to breathe through your nose at night. So those are some of the main things. And then the other thing is that we usually breathe too fast. And most people don't realize that, when you go to the doctor and the doctor measures your respiratory rate and writes down like 12 to 24 breaths per minute, which is the average breathing rate for the average human, at the doctor's office, that's stress breathing. 12 to 24 breaths per minute is how we breathe when we're stressed. What we actually should be breathing at is 5 to 7 breaths per minute most of the time. And so reminding ourselves to breathe intentionally, not just in response to the environment, but to choose to breathe and to try to keep our breath at that 5 to 7 breaths per minute range, which is about 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out, is extremely helpful to not just breathing health, but all health, because it makes sure that it regulates your cardiovascular system, it regulates your immune system, your inflammatory system, and your overall stress levels. And when you start to do that more often, most people find that their thoughts slow down a lot, which is really interesting. And so you start to notice a difference pretty quickly when you do that. And that's also part of the system that Apollo taps into.
That's amazing. As you're sort of talking, I did catch myself. My mind was racing. I wasn't present in this conversation. I think I'm just excited to talk to you, and I have all these different questions. And what has been helping me sort of slow things down was I had my first mushroom experience 8 to 9 months ago. I did, I think, 2 grams, And by the end of it, I was like looking at the sunset. We're at this park, and the feeling was like everything is gonna be okay. And my heart rate slowed down, and now I can remember that experience, feel it now, and recreate that feeling. So that's one amazing tool that I took away from that psychedelic experience, where I'm constantly able to remember that state that I was in, looking at that beautiful sunset, and bring it back to now.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just, it's just practice of awareness, right? So now that you're aware of that, what of that experience of existing under the influence of psilocybin and what that is like, you've expanded your perspective, right? And so now you can go back, and just by remembering that, you can tap into that at any time.
And I remember going into that experience with the intention of just experiencing it for the first time. Hypothetically, let's say I had another 5 grams lying around. Right now, I'm in a pretty good sort of zone. I don't have any questions that I want to ask. I guess the only thing I'm struggling with is productivity and sort of being consistent every day. But I'm sort of pushing through the resistance each morning and trying to get the work done. I'm pretty happy with the path I'm on. I think I heard, do mushrooms expire, by the way? Do they have a half-life? Oh, they don't, so I could store them forever.
Yeah, you probably want to store them in the freezer or something, or like in a mason jar, so that they don't get too much like air contact, so they're like sealed. But yeah, they'll last a really long time.
Oh, cool. Okay, I guess that removes the anxiety to sort of need to use it in the next few months. But at where I am, do you consistently use psychedelics, and do you come in with an intention, or when do you use them, Dave?
Oh, you definitely come in with an intention, because the way that psychedelics work is that they are what's called non-specific amplifiers of awareness. So this is a term that a way that to describe psychedelic experiences that was coined by Dr. Stan Grof, who's a famous psychiatrist, who's one of the first psychiatrists in the world to receive LSD from Albert Hofmann, back in the 40s, and he's a Czech psychiatrist. And he was one of the leaders in figuring out originally like how psychedelics work. And so they amplify whatever it is that you bring into the experience. So if you bring in, a lot of fear, uncertainty, disorganized thinking, restlessness, they could amplify that. And if you have disorganized intentions, they'll amplify the disorganization. If you come in really thoughtful with it for a curated experience, with a lot of intention and planning, it doesn't mean it's going to go exactly as you planned, but you're much more likely to amplify safety and gratitude and self-love and compassion and these kinds of things that are much more like healing than the alternative. And when stuff comes up that's challenging, like maybe you'll remember something from the past that was hard or a challenging experience, and you can actually work through it rather than resisting it. And you mentioned resistance earlier. I think resistance is actually, if you go back to like the ancient Eastern traditions and tribal traditions, resistance is the root of all suffering, because we're resisting what is, right? And what is. It's just it's how things are. So if you don't resist life and what the universe has to offer you, then you're going to be able to be more present and go with the flow, and things will be all of a sudden more joyful and less suffering. And so, one of the questions that you can ask, it might not be at the forefront of your mind, but when you start to end, like go into or plan a psychedelic experience, it's good to have some questions that kind of align with your intention. And one of the questions that you can ask is, why am I resisting? Like, what am I resisting and why? And then oftentimes when you ask yourself that in the experience, the answers will come to you right away, and it'll be like, oh, I'm resisting because I had something happen in the past that taught me to resist these experiences, right? And then all of a sudden, you're like, well, do I need to do that anymore? Not really. It's not serving me. And then you let the resistance go, and then everything becomes easier. Imagine life that we're in, like the life we're all in, is like a rushing waterfall, right? Or a rushing river. And it's just constantly flowing at high speed, tons of water, like hundreds or thousands of gallons of water just constantly rushing, right? And you can get in the water and you can swim with it, or you can float down the stream peacefully, blissfully, or you can get in the stream and you can put your hands up and you can brace yourself and push back on it and be like, no, I am not accepting this, right? And that's resistance. Ultimately, you're going to get washed away eventually, right? You can only resist for so long, but that resistance can cause a lot of pain and suffering in the meantime. So all the therapy that we teach people when we see patients with psychedelic therapy and even just regular old general therapy is teaching people to just let go of the resistance. And Bruce Lee talked about that, right? Like he talked about like be like water. When you are in a cup, you become the cup. When you're in a stream, you become the stream. You don't ask, why am I a stream? You're just in it, right? And if you resist, then you actually pull yourself out of the experience. So it's this constant practice that we can all engage in, that the yogis and the monks have been spending their thousands of years engaging in, of just going with the flow.
Interesting, Dave. So when you wake up, are you not hit with this mass resistance of like, I don't want to write, I don't want to do some research, I don't want to do accounting, I don't want to clear up that list of chores I have. Like, and then you're just sort of paralyzed, and you obviously you get out of your bed and you slowly chip away at things, and once you get the ball rolling, you're feeling amazing. That's, I guess, the experience most productive people deal with. Do you not deal with the resistance at all, or what's your experience been, Dave?
I mean, there's always some resistance, right? Resistance can even be in the form of a question that we ask ourselves, like you wake up in the morning and you're eating your breakfast and somebody texts you something frustrating, right? And then you're like, rather than just going with it and trying to figure it out, you or and sit with the emotions that come up, we say oftentimes, why me? Right? Why me is a resistance statement. So if we ask the wrong questions, then we often don't get the right answers. And why me is the wrong question. It's you because it's you. This is your life. This is what's happening, you know? All we can do is accept things as they are and then try to figure out how to make it better and manifest the reality we want. So, but we all face this every day. Like you know, even the most trained people in meditation, mindfulness, yoga, everyone has a little bit of resistance that tries to kick itself back in there. It's just up to us to be aware of it, to recognize, hey, I'm resisting. I'm resisting whatever it is. I'm having resistance thoughts. I'm trying pushing back. Let's just go with it. And then you start to train yourself to be able to do that more easily.
Very interesting. Over the last few years, as I started my business, started sort of making money and started traveling and sort of started doing all the things that 18-year-old me dreamed of, I started questioning and figuring out my why, my purpose. Like, am I supposed to be waking up each morning and doing these hard tasks and working? That's, you know, finding your purpose, finding your why seems to be a consistent, difficult thing most people deal with. Can psychedelics be like a shortcut to finding your why and purpose?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say there's any shortcuts. The shortcuts is like is you know, the idea of a shortcut is that you're not doing the work, right? And you still have to do the work. So there's no actual shortcut to finding your purpose or the meaning in your life or any of those other things, but there are tools that we can use thoughtfully and intentionally to help us get there faster. And a lot of the time, finding your purpose just requires a little perspective shift, right? So if you're doing the same thing the same way, day in, day out, month after month, year after year, you're just doing it the same way all the time, you start to lose perspective of how you could do things differently. And so when you take a psychedelic medicine, it doesn't have to be a drug, by the way. When you have a psychedelic experience, you can get there with meditation, yoga, sex, you know, sound therapy. There's lots of different ways to get to psychedelic experiences that don't require drugs. But the point is that when you have one of those experiences, it gives you perspective. And when you have perspective, you can look back at the rest of your life and be like, is what I'm spending my time doing what I actually want to be spending my time doing? Right? And that is a good question to ask ourselves. So that is really like when you think about like the right questions to ask, that is the right question. Am I spending my time doing the things that I actually want to be spending my time doing, or would I much rather be spending my time doing something else? And then when you start to ask that question, you start to get perspective on, hey, maybe I actually don't want to be doing what I'm doing. Maybe my purpose or my meaning that I get from my life actually comes from different things. And then you can start to explore those things. But in general, I think the, you know, when we talk about like the meaning of life, I think the main takeaway is that the meaning of life is to discover ourselves, right? It's to discover what we're capable of as human beings in this life. And we don't know what that is necessarily. Nobody hands you a handbook that says, this is your purpose, right? We have to figure that out. But the process of figuring it out is the whole point, right? That's where we learn everything. That's where life becomes really exciting and interesting. So there's not, it's not like the means justify the end. It's the means themselves that are actually the point. And that is the process of self-discovery of our potential. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Sort of going through that journey of figuring yourself out, and that might take your whole life, and that might be it.
Yep.
Interesting. Dave, do you meditate daily? Are there any sort of daily routines that you personally sort of implement to really keep yourself in the best shape possible?
Yes, I think meditation is a little bit different for everyone. I would say it's a very personal thing, right? There's the traditional practice of meditation where you go and sit in a corner on a pillow and you breathe and you cross your legs and you practice like being mindful of your thoughts, right? And that's like what we often think of when we think of meditation. It's a good practice. It's really important to practice that for all of us because it trains attention control, but it's not the only way to meditate. I think if you talk to the most of what I do is what I would call like movement meditation. And what the yogis talk about and the Buddhist Tibetan monks for many millennia is the goal of meditation is to be present. And it's to be as present as possible, as often as possible. So in the moment, not resisting, just going with the flow. And when for me, like when I'm exercising, when I'm going on walks in the forest, when I'm sailing on the lake, you know, and I'm like doing things that really like make me in touch with myself, my body, nature, you know, the universe, whatever you want to call it, that's meditation for me. So I do sitting practices sometimes, but I'm terrible at it as it's hard, you know, so Apollo really helps me get there, but it's hard and it takes a lot of practice and training. So I usually focus on movement meditation for myself.
That's amazing. I've been slowly learning about sailing. I've been doing a bit of windsurfing, a bit of sailing on the B14s that require two people. I don't know what type of sailing you do, but you're right. It sort of forces you to be present. You're constantly having to do micro adjustments and you can't really think about what's going on. So it's like a forced meditation, I guess.
Yep.
That's very cool. I guess, Dave, when was your last psychedelic experience and sort of what made you do it and how consistently have you done it throughout your life?
I actually don't have drug-induced psychedelic experiences particularly often. I am very busy, and so it's very hard to take time out to do those things. My most meaningful psychedelic experiences were probably, and the last ones were, you know, in my ketamine training when we as clinicians have to experience ketamine to learn how to administer it to other people, our patients. And in those are some of, by hands down, the most meaningful, you know, experiences that I've had. And, you know, it's with like 26 other doctors and clinicians. So it's like a really powerful group experience, and you get to see all of your colleagues do it, and then you do it, and you all sit for each other. And that is really, I think, the, you know, for me, like that was just extremely powerful. And everybody had very heart opening, very, you know, just perspective inducing, connecting experiences. And it was just, you know, it was, you know, it's life changing and to have those once in a while. But you know, it's not the kind of thing that we, you know, folks like me can necessarily engage in on a regular basis.
Makes sense. At the moment, Dave, given that you have such a broad spectrum, everything from like studying stress, like doing, you know, therapy and psychedelics, and you run a freaking business and you have your own product, I guess at this chapter of your life, what has been the most exciting? What's the most current thing that has been taking up most of your mind?
I would probably say, I mean, I'm really, passionate about mental health, and the burden of mental health on society is tremendous. Untreated mental illness is, not only the most expensive thing to treat in healthcare, but it's also the most damaging to our quality of life and the people around us. And a lot of people, unfortunately, my background is addiction and trauma psychiatry and neuroscience, and so I've seen a lot of people who the system, the medical system, has failed, who have not been treated adequately by the system. They haven't gotten their goals of health achieved, mental health achieved. And so what do? Well, they go outside the system to get what they want to feel better. And that often involves them using drugs, either legal or illegal. And that is extremely damaging to society, because many of the drugs that people use have side effects and consequences that impair thinking, they impair judgment, insight, our ability to look inside ourselves, decision making, they impair our ability to connect with each other authentically. And so, for me, a lot of my passion has really been around helping people understand that mental illness, in what the modern neuroscience shows, I think fairly strongly, is that most mental illness comes from unaddressed past trauma. And that if we don't get to the root cause of the past trauma, and we or the root situation, which is the past trauma, then people will remain ill as a result of the unaddressed past trauma. And so, and a recent study just came out showing that this is actually, it was from University College of London, actually. They talked about how trauma seems to be much more likely and highly correlated with mental illness than, any evidence for neurotransmitter imbalances in your brain. So when you think about that, the bad news is that we got it wrong, right? The neurotransmitter imbalance theory doesn't hold up. And it's not genetic. But the good news in most cases, but the good news is that because if it's trauma and that's unprocessed, unaddressed trauma, it means we can do something about it, right? And so I think for me, that my biggest passion is that, with all of the advances in the psychedelic medicine field and with technology like Apollo and everything else that's coming, I think we can start to cure mental illness rather than just treat it in the next 5 to 10 years. And we're starting to see the early evidence of that. And that's going to change the world forever. I mean, it's going to be the equivalent to the invention of antibiotics in 1908, right? But for treating mental illness. And that is nothing short of incredible.
Wow, there's so many paths I can take. Last night, I saw this quote by Carl Jung. He said, "Nothing has stronger influence psychologically on their children than the unlived lives of the parent." And the moment I read that, I really saw how a lot of my dreams mirrored my dad's unlived dreams and all the things that he's wanted to do but couldn't have. I'm sort of naturally wanting to achieve. And then that sort of, I thought of that as you were talking about past trauma and yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what the latest research is showing, that those traumatic events actually change our gene expression patterns, like our stress response gene expression on cor of cortisol receptors and things of that nature, which Rachel Yehuda is originally credited for discovering, I think when she was at Yale and Sinai. And this is the modern understanding of trauma, is that it actually changes our biology, right? And if we don't do anything about it, it changes our biology across generations. So we can actually pass down trauma on our genes in terms of, like, what's called epigenetic memory. We can pass that down to our offspring if we don't do anything about it. So it's even more important to stop the cycle of trauma in our generation, because if we stop the cycle of trauma in our generation, the chances of us passing that to our children and our children's children and their children's children goes way, way down, and then the opportunity for healing increases tremendously.
When you say mental illness, what is mental illness, Dave? Like, is it depression, loneliness, burnout, feeling sad? Like, what is mental illness?
So mental illness, defined in the Western medical model, is when you're feeling so sad or so anxious or so upset and stressed out for such a long time, consistently, day in and day out, or more days than not, that it starts to impact your ability to have a good life, to sleep, to have relationships, to be able to work a job and hold down a job, right? That is when we start to call it mental illness in the Western model of medicine. So that's kind of like the modern definition. Almost everyone has some stress that causes some of those problems, but it's not usually so bad that it's every day or multiple times a day or all of those symptoms. It's usually just a little bit here and there, and then we deal with it, we get over it, we move on to the next thing, and we adapt. Mental illness is usually what happens is when we don't adapt, or we haven't learned how to adapt to the stress, and then we wind up having a lot of problems in our lives as a result of it.
What's your thoughts on this statement? If I were to say, if I ate delicious junk food every day, watched Netflix, binge TikTok on my phone, and I do this every single, I'm just sort of doing what my body wants, going with all my cravings, I'll give myself mental illness. By the end of 7 days, I'm gonna feel so depressed, down, sad, loss of purpose, loss of life. Did I just give myself mental illness?
I mean, you can give yourself mental illness because a lot of mental illness is heavily influenced by our behavior and the actions we choose to take, right? So, if to give you a really simple example, if you drink coffee at night for a month every night and you have any sensitivity to caffeine, it's going to mess up your sleep, right? And we'll include in this not just coffee, because coffee is an extreme, but you include coffee, caffeinated teas, stimulant drinks, stimulant drugs, right? You do any of that stuff at night that impairs your quality of sleep. And you do that consistently, and within a month or two or three, your sleep will be so impaired in terms of the quality, good quality rest you're getting, which is where most of our physical and mental recovery happens and our emotional recovery, that you will start to manifest symptoms of mental illness. Does it mean you have a mental illness? Not necessarily, because if you change your behavior and you stop doing it, and you already have somebody help you, guide you to say, hey, maybe you shouldn't be doing that, then all of a sudden you change your behavior and all the symptoms go away and you're feeling better again. So I wouldn't necessarily call that mental illness yet. But if you keep doing it and you don't change your behavior, you can absolutely make yourself mentally ill. And we see that all the time. And there's a lot of patients that I would work with who have what I would call drug-induced mental illness, where or something like that, where it's a behavior usually related to a use of drugs or diet, very poor diet, or just playing video games all the time, not exercising, not taking care of yourself, that can result in mental illness. And that's because we have a mind-body connection that's always there. And many of us were taught growing up, the mind and the body are separate. Well, they're not. Modern neuroscience is very clear. The mind and the body are connected. If we are emotionally or mentally unwell for an extended period of time, it causes physical illness. And if we're physically ill for an extended period of time, we don't do anything about it, it will cause mental and emotional illness. So everything is connected in that way. But usually when we talk about mental illness, it's when somebody has a lot of symptoms that are like actually life impairing. They impair your work, your relationships, your quality of life to a significant degree that prevents you from being able to feel like yourself and be a productive contributing member to society.
Talking about the sort of physical and mental, it reminded me of this story where there was this fit person with a six pack versus this SEAL soldier. I don't know if he was part of a SEAL, but he was a bit more bigger, more unhealthy. And the SEAL guy saw this fit guy come into the squad and was like, "Hey, do you want to go for a half marathon run?" And the big guy smoked the six-pack guy through just having sheer strong mental capabilities, I guess. And then that really, like, I was confused. I was like, but like he's big and unfit. Wouldn't his joints hurt? Wouldn't he be struggling to run? Wouldn't he be out of breath? But somehow he smoked the guy with the six-pack. So I guess,
Yep.
what does that say? Like, does that say that like my it's mind over body?
it yeah, I mean, it does say that, right? It's not there, it's more complicated than that though, because just because you have a six pack doesn't mean that you're physically fit in other ways, right? You can be a great weightlifter and be really like physically muscularly strong, but be a bad runner, right? Because you don't have the cardiovascular endurance to be able to run. We see that a lot in like football players, like linebackers and people like that, that are actually great athletes and they're very physically fit, but they are physically fit to do a specific thing, which is to block tackles, right? And they're not going to be particularly great at going for a long run. So they're not going to excel at that. But I think to the other point that you mentioned is that the mental game is critical. You know, and I work with a lot of elite athletes and elite performers who are pushing themselves to their limit all the time. And, you know, the mental game is at least 50% of the total game, you know, and if you can tune your mental game and train your mind and your body to be in alignment rather than what we would call like dissonant. So there's like harmony, resonance, where everything's working together seamlessly. And then there's dissonance, which is like an orchestra playing out of tune at different times, right? It sounds terrible, right? You take that same orchestra and you have them play the same music in the same tune in the same time. All of a sudden, it sounds beautiful, right? That is the same thing that happens in our bodies and our minds. If our mind is not aligned with our bodies, we have dissonance all the time that we then have to overcome. And it's like you're about to do a race, but then you're telling yourself that you're going to fail and you're not going to succeed. And, you know, there's something wrong with you. Why is everybody else so much faster or better than me? Right? Those are all self-sabotaging thoughts that can result in losing or an increased likelihood of losing compared to somebody who might be slightly less physically fit, but their mental game is tight. And it's in line with their bodies, and they could outperform you in, you know, any time because they are in it and they have trained themselves to be in alignment.
Now, Dave, how do you practice and achieve that alignment? Like, for example, last Sunday, I went on my first ever 10-kilometer jog. Prior to that, I maybe ran 3 kilometers when I was like 15, 16 in high school. And man, like, after 5 kilometers, my body was just screaming, everything hurt. And my mind was like, stop, take a break, get some water. And I'm overriding with, don't give up, shut up. Keep going, you got this, you got this. And it's just this constant gap. Like, I'm playing sort of, I'm battling my own mind. So I guess I'm definitely not in alignment. Or am I tapping into it and tapping out of it as I'm overriding those thoughts saying, you got this, keep going, you got this, take in the beautiful view. Is that alignment? And is it this back and forth, I'm tapping into it, tapping out of it? Or is the fact that I'm tapping in and out means I don't have alignment?
Well, it's the same thing with resistance thinking, right? We were talking about earlier. So it has to do with what we've learned because we are automation machines. So we literally learn behavior and then we put it into practice. And if we don't have perspective and we don't question what we've learned, then we come out of alignment and we make more mistakes. So a big part of it is just the it's called, you know, that's a big part of mindfulness training is mindfulness is about being mindful of what you are paying attention to, what you're aware of. And so the trick is not, it's not, and nobody's perfect. There's no such thing as perfect, right? Everybody falls out of alignment sometimes, but the goal is to notice the early signs of when you're starting to fall out of alignment so that you can realign yourself. So if you're like doing something, and you start to have those thoughts of, I can't do it. I might not be able to do it. I might not succeed. What if I fail? Right? None of those questions matter. It's just the only thing that's important is to notice that you're starting to think that way, and then consciously, intentionally redirect your attention back to the moment and what you're doing and how much you, and what you're grateful for about yourself, about the experience, and just try to take it all in. And that reestablishes alignment, but it just requires practice. And the more that you practice, the more seamless it gets. It just becomes automatic. But if we never learn that, then it takes time to get back there.
That's so cool, Dave. Dave, is there a correlation between social media and the growth of it and sort of mental illness? And as like time goes on with AI, it's, the algorithm is going to get stronger. It's going to know exactly what would give you dopamine. Like, can products like the Apollo beat that or sort of balance that out? Or yeah, like what's the solution?
Sorry, the solution for?
For social media and content consumption and AI giving you more dopamine for very little effort, and it basically becoming this drug that everyone is hooked on.
Yeah, I mean, the solution is to be mindful, right? So if you think about what many people use social media for, it's for distraction from discomfort, right? Why is that interesting? Because the same reason why people use cocaine, same reason why people use tobacco, oftentimes alcohol, you know, sedative drugs, all of these things are used and relied on by people mostly to distract or numb us to discomfort. And discomfort is a normal part of life. And if we're taught to avoid discomfort, then we, and not be mindful of our emotions, then when we, as soon as we start to feel uncomfortable, we go for the drug or we go for the phone, right? So it's about being mindful of that process and mindful of when we're feeling uncomfortable. And rather than going straight for the phone or the drug, you ask yourself the question, well, why am I feeling uncomfortable right now? Right? What might be causing me to feel this way? And as soon as you ask that question, there's going to be an emotion that pops up or a thought. And that's going to show you exactly why you're feeling the way you're feeling. And it's going to say, oh, I was thinking about how I did something wrong the other day and how I should have done it better. And now I'm feeling ashamed and guilty and I screwed it up. And what's wrong with me, right? And so as you start to notice that, then all of a sudden the emotions come up, right? The guilt, the shame, the fear of failure, right? The emotions that get associated with that. And then we can, if we feel those emotions, so a lot of what we teach in therapy is how do you learn to just sit with your emotions? Because emotions aren't good or bad, contrary to popular opinion. Emotions are really just signals to us that there's something in the environment or within us that is asking for our attention. So if you notice the emotion, notice the feeling, the thought, and then actually sit with it for a second, usually within 60 to 90 seconds, that emotion processes and fades right away. And then you're feeling great again. But if the if you follow that impulse to say, oh, well, I need to avoid this. I don't want to feel this. I don't like it. What are you doing? You're resisting, right? And what happens when you resist? Well, you wind up going back to social media or something like that to scroll, to distract yourself. And then when you turn off your phone, you go back to regular life, guess what? The emotion's still there and still uncomfortable. We have to process these feelings, and feelings were meant to be felt. If we have feelings and don't feel them, then those feelings are still there and they need to be processed so they can be released. So that is really the antidote to those kinds of addictive behaviors, which are not unique to drugs. Social media is also addictive behavior. What else is addictive behavior common in society? Earning money, right? Money is as addictive as cocaine, and it works in the exact same parts of the brain as cocaine. It activates the same reward centers. And what happens when you earn money? You just want more of it, right? Same as cocaine. So when you think about that and you think about the neurobiology of behavior, it's really about understanding this stuff about yourself and how we work as humans. Because when you understand it, then you can do something about it. And that's why we created Apollo, because many of us were just not taught any of this stuff. So if we weren't taught it, then our minds and bodies don't know it. But we figured out that you can send a nice, gentle signal to the body that reminds us to be mindful and present. And when you're reminded to be mindful and present, all of a sudden it becomes easier to sit with your emotions, and then you can process that shit and let it go.
Wow. Because I was gonna say, like, it's hard, nearly impossible to tell people to eat healthy, fast, delete social media apps off their phone, go outside, but it's much easier to tell them to just put on this clip.
Yep. And that's just a start, right? Most of us are not feeling good enough to do a lot of those things. And when you're stressed, change becomes hard. Our bodies actually, most people don't know this. This is like a lot of the teaching that I do. But our bodies are evolved to resist change when we're stressed out and we don't feel good. Because change is new, and newness might mean uncertainty, and uncertainty might mean an actual threat. So we evolve to oppose change, even though it might be healthy for us when we're already stressed out. So Apollo helps to calm the body by reminding us we're safe and we're not under threat, and then change becomes easier.
What's the difference between a Polar, which can say send a vibration every 10 seconds, versus wearing like a G-Shock watch that you set to beep every 10 seconds? Is it the same thing or are there differences?
So Apollo delivers. And anybody who has an iPhone can experience this by downloading the Apollo app and see how different the vibrations of Apollo are, as a demo. But if you, the Apollo vibrations are very specific, patented vibration rhythms that we discovered at the University of Pittsburgh in the Department of Psychiatry, originally to treat PTSD. And then we used them ourselves in our prototyping days and liked them so much that we realized this was working for us. And we should release this to everyone. But Apollo works by delivering those soothing vibrations to the body that induce the state of coherent breathing in the body. So it's the same state that we enter when we start to enter a meditative state, but you can induce it using sound. And we, you know, you've listened to meditation music before, right? So you know that meditation music helps you get into a meditative state by calming your body through your ears. So Apollo is our version that we discovered how to do that by not using your ears, but by using your skin. So it's those specific vibration patterns that are important, and not all vibrations or sound are created equal.
Wow. Does that mean that all our audience, all our viewers can simply download the Polar app, put it in their pocket, and it will vibrate every 10 seconds, and they could just go on the day and just keep it in their pocket, against their thighs? And would that sort of, is that the best way to use it, or how would you recommend them use the app on their iPhone?
So, on the phone specifically.
Yes.
So the phone is just a demo.
Okay.
So that's not the full experience. That just shows you, if you're listening to this right now and you want to feel Apollo, you can feel Apollo and try it on your phone. But the wearable itself, like I'm wearing on my chest right here,
Yes.
you can wear it anywhere on your body, and the wearable delivers the soothing vibrations, 10 or 12 different vibration patterns. And you can turn them on anytime you want to access more energy or more creativity or in social energy or focus flow or recovery or sleep, unwinding, calm, meditation, etc. Or you can, my favorite part of the app is you can have it do this for you automatically by scheduling your vibes for you. So you can, you know, if I know when I want to wake up, and I know when I want to go to bed, and I know, generally speaking, when I want to be focused and in, you know, heads down in work, or when I need to be creative and in my social flow or meditating, I can schedule all of that in the app, and the app can also schedule that for you. And then it saves those schedules of rhythms to the device, and then that regulates your whole circadian rhythm for you. So it keeps you awake when you need to be awake, and keeps you asleep when you need to be asleep. And that's basically how it works. So you can imagine it really helps, like, things like shift workers, eliminating jet lag, and things that are, you know, when you have a lot of stress in your life and you have trouble like calming down or trouble white ramping up to do anything, it really helps with that. And sleep is the biggest benefit that people get out of Apollo.
It feels like this like healthy version of like a study drug such as Ritalin. So I could use it from 9 to 5, put it on focus, productive mode, and it will tap me into the state as if I was on Ritalin, but it's just these healthy vibrations. Do you wear it all the time? When do you get to charge it? Do you use it when you're running and jogging during physical exercise?
I use Apollo about 4 to 6 hours a day. I wear it all day. And I have my own schedule. So it wakes me up in the morning with gentle, energizing vibrations that get me out of bed. And then usually after I get up and it wakes me up, I throw it on the charger and then I go do my like shower, brush my teeth, do my morning routine. And then I go back, take it off the charger. I put on my good morning vibe, which is good morning flow. So it's like a gentle, light, kind of like fluffy, nice morning energy. Kind of feels like sitting out in the sun first thing in the morning. And I use that for about 90 minutes. And then I'm in focus mode for the rest of the day. And usually, and then in the evenings, I'll throw it on the social vibe, which helps with my creativity and social energy when I have to go out and I'm tired, or I have to network with people and I'm tired. It's also the social vibe is also what I use when I have to be like, you know, my energetic, fun-loving self after I've been on long trips and I have to give a lot of talks and lectures. So that is just really calming. It's great for public speaking and just kind of like evening you out. And then when the nighttime comes again in the evening, after dinner, my Apollo turns on the unwind vibe right before I would get into bed for about a half hour. And it winds me down because, as you mentioned earlier, I'm, you know, a fairly high energy fellow. So I like to work at night and I'll stay up late working if I don't have a reason to go to bed. But I need to sleep to recover. So I have it set to unwind a half an hour before I get into bed. It winds me down and kind of gets me into a really relaxed state. But even before I get into bed, while I'm doing my nightly routine, the brushing the teeth, the washing the face, all that stuff. And then it starts the sleep vibes when I get into bed, and then that helps keep me asleep at night and helps me fall asleep in bed. A lot of elite athletes use Apollo for what you described earlier, which is getting into a flow state before you get on the court or on the field and helping you really get in the zone. A lot of folks have to work to get into the flow after you get on the field. So this gets you into the flow before you get on the field and keeps you there. And then they use recover, unwind, and sleep after the game or after the practice to help them fall asleep quickly without drugs or alcohol or anything like that.
Wow, this definitely feels like an amazing shortcut. We did talk about how there's no such thing, but like as an introvert, when I go to events, gathering, I have to really switch on and really exert a lot of energy. And when I come back, I'm exhausted. But it seems like that tool can help me with that as well. Where do you discreetly wear it when you're sort of going out?
When I go out, I usually wear it on my ankle. The ankle is my absolute favorite spot because when I wear it on my ankle, I feel it through my whole body. But the other place that I like to wear it when I go out is on my chest, like you're seeing here, because Apollo is basically wearable bass music that's composed for your body instead of your ears. So it's when I say bass, what I mean is the same sound waves that come out of your subwoofer or the subwoofer at a party you might be at are the same frequencies that come out of the Apollo, but they're composed specifically for your touch receptors to induce a state of calm. And so wearing it on a bone, a big bone in your body, like your sternum, or wearing it on your ankle, your leg bones are amongst the biggest bones in the body, or your hip on your belt, I think that feels the best out of any of the other locations. So that's usually where I wear it when I go out.
That is so freaking amazing. I'd love to try it for 30 days, document the before and after, see my sleep score, see how it changes, I guess, over 30 days. So that's definitely something I'd love to do. Over the last 18 days, I've deleted all the social media apps on my phone, unplugged my TV, drastically reduced sort of content consumption. And after 7 days, for the last 10 days, I've been consistently remembering my dreams every time I wake up. Every time I wake up, I write down my dreams if I can remember them. But prior to that, I was just waking up and not remembering my dreams. So somehow by removing all this stimuli, I'm more rested. I'm somehow waking up remembering my dreams. It's as if sort of consuming contents stops you from dreaming.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's dreaming. Dreams are complicated. I think most of us probably dream most nights, but we don't necessarily remember those dreams. So, if you're having REM sleep at night, if you're getting any REM sleep at night, which most humans get for at least a little bit of the night, you are dreaming during that time. Whether you remember it or not is up to you, right? Not everybody remembers it. If you use cannabis, you're probably going to dream less. Like high THC containing cannabis seems to reduce dreams or reduce dream memory, especially when used before bed. Alcohol, it seems, probably does the same thing. There are other things like passion flower that actually seems to increase dreams and increase vividness of dreams. There's some like blueberry extract people take before bed that can increase intensity of dreams. But in general, I think most of us dream most nights and we just don't remember it.
Oh, interesting. Yes, it was weird how, like, doing this every time I do a sort of social media detox and sort of go into this sort of monk mode, I do find myself remembering my dreams. I heard this guy named Tai Lopez. He says everyone should get 3 hours of deep sleep. Is that possible? I sometimes teeter against the 2 hour mark, but like, how do you get to 3 hours of deep sleep? Is that possible and is it needed?
I mean, you want to get as much deep and REM sleep as possible because deep sleep is when we get the most physical recovery in our bodies, and REM sleep is when we get the most mental, emotional recovery. And that's when a very important process happens in REM sleep called memory consolidation. So that's when short-term memories get filtered and turned into long-term memories and organized in our long-term memory brain in the cortex. So we want to get as much deep and REM sleep as possible. I used to think that 3 hours, 2 to 3 hours of deep sleep for the average 6 to 8 hour night is un was too much. Like, it was unreasonable. It was like impossible to get. But once I started using Apollo, my deep sleep doubled. So, I think it's absolutely possible. It's really just about calming our bodies enough to be able to enter those states, because sleep. What we don't talk about it that much this way, it's starting to be talked about more by people like Michael Breus, a leading sleep expert, Michael Gervais, who's a leading elite performance psychologist. Sleep is our most vulnerable physical state of being, right? When you're in deep sleep, when you're in REM sleep, you're basically physically defenseless. And in REM sleep, we're basically paralyzed. So for us to be able to access those states of recovery, we have to feel safe enough to be able to be that vulnerable. And if we don't feel safe in any way, the body shuts down deep in REM sleep and we don't get enough of it. So for me, just seeing the effect of Apollo, which is like a neural safety-based technology, we were able to see something really interesting, which is that deep sleep goes up a lot. And REM sleep too, because people are feeling safe enough to be able to drop into those states. And that seems to make a huge difference in your overall health.
During summer, I sleep with all my doors open, all the windows are open, and I don't know if that psychologically affects my sleep because now I know that there's like a screen door that someone can cut and just jump through the window. Obviously, I live in a decently safe neighborhood, but could Apollo counter things such as that?
Could Apollo count on things such as?
Such as me. In the summer, I sleep with all my doors open, all my windows open, so air flows in. So I think psychologically, I feel like the house is less protected.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I mean, to some extent, right? The question is, when you're I, the question I would ask you is, when you do that, when you're sleeping, are you actually is there actually a threat? So
No.
if there's not a threat, but we think there might be subconsciously, then that's going to impair our sleep.
Yes.
The other th so Apollo helps with that. The other one that's really common is that I see all the time, and then my sleep specialist colleagues see all the time, is people tell themselves a story that there's something wrong with them, that they can't sleep well, and that everybody else around them can somehow sleep well, but they can't, right? So think about what that does to your brain. That is inducing a learned fear response around something's wrong with me, so I can't sleep. So you start to believe that you can't sleep, and then you start to believe there's something wrong with you, and you start to feel unsafe in your own body, right? So that, I would say, is probably one of the most common thought processes around sleep disturbances and insomnia that tools like Apollo, breathing, soothing touch, progressive muscle relaxation, tension relaxation, those kinds of techniques, and things like cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, those all work really well for that. But it requires a lot of practice. And Apollo is nice because you don't have to practice anything. You can just put it on and it helps take you there. But we have to remember that not to think about ourselves that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like 99% of people in the world, if not more, we're all born to sleep a third of our lives, and we are physiologically programmed to do so. The only thing that gets in the way is us. There's only like two families, one or like, I think it's like maybe two or three families worldwide that have a genetic disease disorder that prevents them from sleeping. Everybody else can sleep and they can sleep well, but we have to feel safe enough to do so.
My current average REM and deep is probably 1.5 hours, 1.5 hours. What was your average REM and deep sleep before the Apollo and now using it for how long?
I mean, I've been using Apollo for a long time. My wife Catherine is the co-founder and CEO. We've been using Apollo for probably 4 years, maybe just over 4 years, almost every day. When we started, I was working at the hospital full time. I was working like 80-hour weeks. I was busy, and I was probably getting at most an hour of deep sleep and maybe like 45 minutes of REM sleep a night. Now I'm getting easily double that almost every night.
With the same 6 hours.
6 to 8 hours depends on the night. I mean, I was sleeping 6 to 8 hours back then. I was just, working more. But yeah, with the same 6 to 8 hour window, I'm getting now double what I was getting before.
That is so impressive. That's so amazing. One last mental health question I want to get your thoughts on. I realized, so the other day I realized if someone invites me to an event and I politely declined, I don't feel any type of way. If someone forgets to invite me to an event, so I don't go, I feel left out, a bit sad. If someone purposely excluded me from an event, I feel really sad. And it's weird how in those three scenarios, it's the same thing, same outcome. I didn't go, but in those three scenarios, I feel a different type of way. So the other day, I was put in the third scenario and I felt really, really sad. I felt really left out, really lonely, and it really threw me off that afternoon mentally. What's your thoughts on that thing I just shared?
Well, I guess I would ask you the question, in those three circumstances, circumstance number one, you choose not to go, right? What does that mean about you?
That I didn't want to go, I chose not to, I wanted to be asked.
Right. So, but what, no, the first one is you were asked, but you chose not to, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So in that circumstance, you made a decision that you were in control of, where you said, I'm making a conscious choice with this opportunity that I'm not going to participate,
Yes.
right? Second scenario was you forget to go, but you were invited.
Or they forgot to invite me.
Oh, they forgot to invite you. And what is that? What, when you're in that situation, what do you feel that means about you?
It means I wasn't top of mind, I was left out, even though I wouldn't have wanted to go anyways, I would have wanted to be thought of.
Right. So you feel left out, you feel deprioritized, you feel like, oh, maybe these people don't actually care about me that much, right? So what are you doing in those two different scenarios? And the third one, same thing, right? Where they just don't invite you at all, they choose not to, then you start to think the same things. You're taking it personally, right? But you don't actually know what's going on in the other person's head,
Yeah.
right? Maybe their event only had room for 10 people and they had too many people show up in the first place. And that's why they didn't invite you, because it was a small venue and there wasn't enough room for all their friends to come, right? Maybe somebody there got sick and, who knows? Who knows what it was, right? But the point is that your perspective, our perspective of those situations, your perspective is not unique. I think most people respond the same way that you're talking, that you would, about how you would respond. But if you take it personally, that is the number one biggest mistake that we make, which causes us pain, which is this thing happened because this person doesn't trust me, like me, respect me enough. I don't mean enough to them, right? And when we start to go down that path, that's a path that's very upsetting and not even necessarily true, right? We don't know that it's true. And so we feel bad because in that situation, because we didn't have a choice, right? We were just left out. When you have a choice to be left out, you made the choice. So maybe you still have FOMO, but you made the choice, right? So it doesn't, we don't automatically make an association between I was left out and it means something about me in this relationship. Does that make sense? So the choice is empowering. The choice is important. And especially in our society, it doesn't mean that anything's different about you in either situation. It just means that having a choice makes us feel in control, and having control makes us feel certain, which makes us feel safe.
That's amazing. Dave, I can go forever. I usually wrap up these podcasts with two questions. One, any recent discoveries that you have implemented to your life?
I'm sorry, any recent?
Any recent discoveries that you have implemented to your life?
Oh yeah, there's so many. I mean, I think for me, it's a lot of there's just constants, you know. Life is so interesting in that we can discover, if we have an open mind, we can discover new things about us, ourselves, and about life every day. Sometimes like every moment of every day. One of the things that I recently discovered that was really meaningful to me was, you know, we were talking about breathing earlier and how breathing is one of the single most important ways for us to connect with ourselves and with nature. And that simply by teaching ourselves to breathe properly, meaning starting with just not even worrying about how much, how fast, or anything like that, just taking your attention, your mind's spotlight, and putting it on your breath, and just saying, I'm going to choose choice, right? I'm going to choose to breathe right now, right? That almost instantly reminds us that we're safe and we're in control in this moment. And nothing is more powerful than being able to show yourself, not just tell yourself, but to show yourself that you're actually safe and in control in the moment. So that has been something that I've discovered more recently about breath that I think has been really powerful for me, in particular. And now it's just been about practicing it, right? Practicing to remembering to breathe intentionally more often. And then one of the other things that I learned recently when I was at a conference was this idea of what we call in therapy observer mind, which in therapy I understood very well because we use it every day. And it's this idea of, okay, we're going to have a conversation and I am going to be your listener. And I'm going to sit here and I'm just going to listen to whatever you have to say and just watch and listen. And I'm not going to judge. I'm not going to, you know, have any thoughts that I'm going to follow down the path. I'm not going to, you know, wait for my opportunity to say anything. I'm just going to let you talk and I'm going to listen to you in an undivided way where I'm just watching, I'm just observing you. However, doing that for yourself is really hard. Like getting into observer mind for yourself, where you just kind of take your, you get out of thinking mind where you're constantly thinking all the time and doing things all the time. And you just kind of take that part and you just kind of pull it back and you just watch yourself be yourself, right? Just watch yourself exist. And that form of observer mind is also something that we were all born with as humans. We can all train ourselves to do it. It sometimes takes a little bit of practice. We also call it like non-judgmental self-reflection or non-judgmental observation, because you're not judging. We judge a lot. We're really hard on ourselves. It's just watching what's happening without judgment. And I learned recently when I was at an event that I can do that anytime for myself. It's not just when I'm in the doc in the therapist chair, right? It's actually when I'm anytime I can do that for myself. And that my bot when I do that, what comes to mind is I'm able to learn and observe how much I've learned as a human being in this lifetime, right? So to give you an example, I was in this conference and I was just got there and there's a ton of new people. I don't know most people and I'm walking through and I find myself starting to get a little bit nervous. And I haven't been nervous in these situations in a long time, but I just started to find myself getting a little nervous. And I said, okay, I'm just going to watch myself. I know, I just said to myself, I'm like, look, I've been here 1,000 times before. I've done so many events, so many speaking engagements. I'm a seasoned speaker. I know how to do this and exist in this place and be peaceful in existing in this space. So as I was thinking about that, I thought, well, okay, if I've done this so many times before, and our bodies and brains are really, really good at learning stuff and automating stuff, that's what we are. We're like, humans are like these incredible automation machines. The more we practice anything, the better we get and the less we have to think about it. I thought, well, what if I just, rather than thinking about all these anxious, nervous thoughts, what if I just watch myself do what I know how to do and just see if I know how to do it without overthinking it? And so I put myself in my observer mind and I just watched myself go through the conference venue, wave at people, say hi, hold doors open, you know, do all the things and then give interviews and talk. And I realized it was an incredible realization for me because I realized how well I had actually trained myself over the years to do this. And I don't need to think about it so much, right? I don't need to overthink it. I don't need my frontal thinking cortex of my brain to always be engaged, active, planning, worrying all the time, right? That's actually not that important most of the time. What's important is just letting myself be and just letting myself do the things that I know how to do. And so it was like a really interesting opportunity for me to understand the neuroscience that I was studying combined with the psychology of learning and automation, and then allowing myself to watch myself do it was so self-affirming because it made me realize how capable I am and how well I've trained myself to do all these things. And that just totally shifted my mindset. Like for ever since I had that experience, I have been getting better at practicing, just letting myself be and letting myself do what I know how to do. And then at the times I need to think and I need to bring my thinking brain in, I do. But most of the time I don't, and that's okay. And that freed up, like, I don't know, 30% of my cognitive resources that I realized I was spending like worrying and overthinking stuff. And I'm actually performing at a higher level, which is really interesting.
That is amazing. Is it like sort of playing a game where you have this camera behind you and you're sort of looking down on yourself as if you're a third player, third sort of like a game character? Is that sort of the perspective?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of that perspective in that it's like a third person perspective when you're watching yourself, right? But what's different is that in the game, when you're playing a role-playing game, you still have to think about what decisions to make, right? You have to think about what actions to take. So this is one step beyond that, where I said, I am not going to try to control or analyze or judge or think. I'm just going to watch and let myself do stuff and see what happens. And that was next level, because that showed me how much I've learned about how to just do the things. I didn't have to think about, I think I was more in the RPG third party mindset before, where I was thinking about every action. And what I realized is I don't need to think about every action. I know how to do most of the stuff. I know how to listen. I know how to talk. I know how to walk. I know how to be courteous and kind to people. I know how to have normal, friendly human interactions. I don't need to question everything all the time, you know? So it was more like that, which was really enlightening for me.
That is amazing. Dave, where can people find more about you, learn more from you? How can they check out Apollo? What are the best places for them to get everything?
So you can, thank you so much for having me. You can find me at my personal website at drdave.io. You can find Apollo Neuro at APOLLONEURO.com, ApolloNeuro.com. If you want an easier one, you can go to wearablehugs.com, which is what the kids call it. And if you want to find me on social media, at Dr. David Rabin on Instagram and Twitter. And if you want to learn more about my work in the psychedelic and consciousness space, I have two shows that I put out. One of them is biweekly. It's called The Psychedelic Report. It's the leading psychedelic news show. You can learn all about the latest goings on from myself and other experts in the field about the psychedelic science space. And the other one is called Your Brain Explained, which is about the latest discoveries in consciousness, AI, psychedelics, and other things that are really changing the way we think about being human on this earth in this lifetime, and how to translate some of those discoveries into, the life that we all want for ourselves and for the planet. And you can find those both on Spotify and Apple Music.
That's amazing, Dave. Thank you so much for your time today. I had so much fun. We hit so many different topics, and I could definitely feel that I'm just scratching the surface. You have this wealth of knowledge, and I could dig through it forever, but we're both limited on time. So thank you for graciously giving me some of your time and energy today. I just love how passionate you are about all these topics, and you actually want change. Like what you said about how in 5 years we could cure sort of mental illness, like wow, like this is something that you're definitely sort of passionate about, and you want to create that revolutionary change. So thank you, Dave.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Guys, if you made it this far into the episode, please let me know your thoughts. Hopefully you guys got value from this episode, and I'll see you guys next week on another episode of the podcast. Peace.